saw that from the beginning of Mark chapter 2 to the early verses of chapter 3, there is a series of five incidents. These five incidents, they're all marked by a common theme. That theme, you may remember, was a theme of controversy or scandal. Each of the five incidents inform us that Jesus faced hostility and opposition. Wherever he went, there was controversy. There was scandal. A dictionary definition of scandal is a person, thing, or circumstance that causes disgrace or outrage. A person, thing, or circumstance that causes disgrace or outrage. And that's a good description of what we see in these verses before us this morning. The message of Jesus provokes disgrace and outrage. It always has, and it always will. And we're going to see that in Jesus coming to this world to die in our place as a substitute for sinners, that that's a scandalous thing. His grace knows no limits. We see scandal in our passage this morning. We see it in three ways. Firstly, the scandalous call of Levi. Verses 13 and 14, the scandalous call of Levi. Here's Jesus, and he's teaching on the shore of Galilee. And as he walks along the shore, he sees the local tax office. The tax office was a table down on the sand. When the boats came in, if there were cargo, then there were taxes to pay. The tax collector was a man employed by the Roman government. And he could charge whatever he felt he could get away with, as long as he gave a certain amount to the Roman government. And tax collectors were regarded as selfish, money-grabbing, self-centered thieves. And this certain tax collector is a man called Levi. Now, you couldn't like this guy less. He was a Jew. And as such, he had applied to the Roman authorities that he might collect taxes in this certain area. He had applied for this job to work for the enemy. And he's an outcast, therefore. He's as much an outcast as the leper that we saw at the end of chapter 1, if not more so, because Levi was a tax collector by choice. In fact, according to Jewish custom, a Jew who collected taxes, they were expelled from the synagogue. They were considered a curse of disgrace to their own family. And even the touch of such a person, even the touch of a tax collector, rendered a house unclean. So Levi, he's not a popular guy. A very shallow comparison might be those men and women who parade our footpaths wearing the bright red coats with their little notepads, stopping every now and then, placing parking tickets on a car. Not very popular. But Levi, he's far worse, because his life is one of dishonest greed and manipulation. And Jesus spots him. Now, what does Jesus do? What would you expect Jesus to say to such a man? Rebuke him? Curse him? Punish him? Well, not quite. Look at verse 14. As Jesus walked along, he saw Levi sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, Jesus told him. Follow me. Jesus called this man to be one of his disciples. He picks Levi. This is unbelievable. Nobody picked Levi for anything. Levi would have been the last one standing when teams were being picked for the Galilee football tournament. no one like them. And Jesus picks him to be in his team. Along with Peter, James, and John, Jesus picks Levi, the most unlikely person. What scandal. Levi, the cheat, now a disciple. And friends, this is Levi who would become known as Matthew. This is the Matthew who would write the first gospel, the fullest gospel. Friends, this is no less than an apostle and an evangelist whose history we have before us this morning. And so don't we learn something about the power of Christ's call? He can call men like Levi out from the world to be his disciples. He said, "Follow me." And what do we read? Levi got up and followed him. Friends, we ought never to despair of anyone's conversion when we have these words in front of us this morning. Because the Christ who called Levi still calls people today. Yes, the love of money is still powerful, but the call of Christ is more powerful. The voice that said to Levi, "Follow me," may yet call those who are dearly loved to you and as yet outside the kingdom. We may yet see them arise and follow Christ. So let us hope continually, and let us pray for such people. Who can tell what God may be going to do for anyone around us? Levi shows us no one is too bad for Christ to call. Through Christ there is grace to pardon the greatest sins. There is grace to sanctify the greatest sinners. It's amazing, isn't it? This call of Levi. Some of us are Christians this morning and we think, "God picked me, I must be special." No, no, no. God is the one who's special. God chose the lowly, the weak, the despised, the things that are not, to shame the things that are. God picks nobodies and he loves them. That's my story and that's your story if you're a Christian this morning. And that's the way God is. He doesn't look at us and find us to be lovely. He loves us until we become lovely. That's how God works. And it's truly scandalous, this call of Levi. That's the first thing this morning. This scandalous call of Levi. Don't lose heart for any who you love who are as yet outside of Christ. Secondly, then, the scandalous eating with sinners. And this is verses 15 to 17. The scandalous eating with sinners. Here's Levi. He's walked away from his crooked, corrupt job. Becoming a Christian sometimes requires that. What does he do immediately afterwards? Verse 15. He invites all of his friends over to his house to meet Jesus. Here's Levi, the tax collector turned missionary. And here is Jesus eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners. And listen to what happens. The religious people, the teachers of the law, they start criticizing. They start saying, "What in the world is Jesus doing?" The Pharisees, they're not impressed. Now this is our first reference to Pharisees in Mark's Gospel. Pharisees were a small group of people who held that keeping the law was the primary religious duty. And they determined that the law contained 613 commandments. They had 613 commandments, 248 positive ones, 365 negative. In short, to be a Pharisee was really to live a life of do's and don'ts. And among those don'ts was the Pharisees' refusal to buy food from or eat food in the homes of those who were not Pharisees, in case the food had not been tithed, and that they should thus break one of their laws. But here's Jesus, and he's doing exactly what the Pharisees refrain from doing. And it's scandalous. They are outraged. They ask his disciples, "What is Jesus doing, eating with tax collectors and sinners?" Well, listen to how Jesus responds. This is quite a famous verse, Mark 2, verse 17. Jesus said to them, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." If you looked at a doctor and he was surrounded with sick people, you would not say, "What a horrible doctor that is." You would say, "What a good doctor." That's what doctors do. They spend time with sick people to make them better. Here Jesus is saying, he is the great doctor. He saw us all sick with a mortal disease, stricken with the plague of sin. And he pitied us. He came down from heaven with divine medicine for our souls. He came to give health and life to the dying. He came to heal the brokenhearted. He came to give strength to the weak. He is the great doctor. He spends time with sick sinners. And friends, the closer you get to Jesus, the longer you spend with Jesus, the more you realize you're a sinner, and that you're sick, and that you're selfish, and that you need Jesus to be your great doctor. Because the truth is, we're all sinners. We're all sick with sin. And we all need the great doctor. And that was a great mistake the Pharisees made. The Pharisees thought they were fine. They didn't realize they were sick. And Jesus makes it very clear, doesn't he? He's not interested in people who think they're fine. He didn't come for those who thought they were well, but he came for those who were sick. He says, "I've come for people who realize they're sinners." He will have nothing to do with people who think they're all right. Isn't that a frightening thing? He will have nothing to do with people who think they're all right. That's the most dangerous position to be in, to think you're okay. That's a big problem with so many people in North Down. They think they're okay. That's a great problem with so many people who come along to church every week. They think they're okay. They're never troubled by their sin. They have no idea how sick they really are. They have no idea how sinful their sin is. They think they're okay. But Jesus has nothing to do with people who think they're okay. In fact, you'll never be saved if you think you're okay. You'll never be saved if you think you're okay. But here's this person, and he's weighed down. He's troubled by his sin. He can't sleep. He feels like he's caught a fatal disease. He can't cure himself. He can't live with it any longer. He's thinking about one thing only. How can I get rid of my sin? And it's for people like that that Jesus came. He's the great doctor. So friends, are we remotely aware of our great wickedness and sinfulness? Do we feel as if we are unworthy of anything but wrath and condemnation? Well, then let us understand we're the very people for whose sake Jesus came into the world. If we consider ourselves righteous, he has nothing to do with us. Scandalous. But if we feel ourselves sinners, That's exactly who Christ calls. So the scandalous eating with sinners. If you think you're okay, that's a big problem, Jesus says. So the scandalous call of Levi, the scandalous eating with sinners. Thirdly, the scandalous attitude to traditions. The scandalous attitude to traditions. Verses 18 to 22. Here are the disciples of John the Baptist, and here are the Pharisees, and they are fasting. In fact, the Pharisees, they fast 2 whole days a week. It was one of their rules. Mondays and Thursdays, by the way. Mondays and Thursdays were the fast days for the Pharisees. And everybody could see they were fasting. They looked as miserable as sin. Fasting was a sign of great sorrow or misery. But here is Jesus and his disciples, a third group. And they're eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners. There's not a sign, there's not a whisper that his disciples are fasting. People are looking at these three groups, John's disciples, the Pharisees, and Jesus' disciples, and they're saying, look, Jesus, your disciples come third in the spirituality league table. They come up and ask him, verse 18, how is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not? Now, God had established only one fast day each year, the Day of Atonement. Men could fast for many good reasons on other occasions. Jesus himself fasted, remember, for 40 days on one occasion. And the question whether we should fast today or not, that's a good one we can consider in our midweeks this week. But to insist on such fasting as the Pharisees did, that was to go beyond the law of God. And to insist on what God has not insisted on is wrong. Really, in a way, though, fasting isn't the real issue here behind this question. Because fasting was just one amongst many traditions and ceremonies in Judaism. The question really is much wider than the fasting issue. The people watching Jesus, they're thinking to themselves, if Jesus doesn't teach his disciples to fast, what else is he not teaching them to do? What about the rest of the traditions? What about the rest of the ceremonies? And Jesus answers by giving 3 illustrations. Firstly, verses 19 to 20, he says that his disciples are like wedding guests. Now, wedding celebrations in a Jewish village lasted 7 days. I'm sure Victor is glad that that practice has changed somewhat. Friends back then and guests, they had no responsibilities but to enjoy the festivities. There was an abundance of food and wine. There was so much song and dance, 7 whole days of it. And when Jesus speaks of the guests of the bridegroom, he's referring to those who were invited to the bride, to the wedding party, those who were waiting impatiently to eat. Maybe you've been there, you've been invited to a wedding, and the day has gone on a wee bit, things have got later and later. You're sitting down at the meal time, you find out the speeches are first, the speeches go on and on and on, and you're hungry, and you're ready to eat. Any thought of fasting at such a moment, that's out of the question. In fact, it would be inappropriate to fast, because guests should be feasting in their joy. Fasting would be out of place. That's what Jesus is saying. He says, I'm the bridegroom. Why should my disciples fast when I'm standing here with them? In fact, he says there will come a time, a sorrowful time, when he would be taken away from them. So they're not fasting, in short, because they're not sad. That's the first illustration. And Jesus gives two more. We need to really think a bit more about these next illustrations. They refer to common practices of that day, maybe not so much to our day. Verses 21 and 22. The first pictures a new patch of cloth sewn onto an old garment. And when washed, the new patch would shrink, causing a tear in both the garment and the patch. The second talks about old wineskins. Now, wineskins are made of animal skins. They had a certain give to them, and they needed that because when wine was poured into it, the wine fermented and bubbled, and so they would need to swell up for the wine. But old wineskins, they had already reached their limits, and they were brittle. And so Jesus talks about old wineskins filled with new wine that ferments and expands, bursting the old and brittle skins. And so both the wine and the wineskins come to ruin. The point Jesus is making is that you can't put something new into something old. He says, I am like that new piece of cloth. I am like that new wine. And I am not an attachment to the way things were. I'm the fulfillment of the way things were. I'm the fulfillment of the Old Testament ceremonies and rituals and regulations. My coming into the world supersedes and replaces and surpasses everything to do with the old system. The old is gone, the new has come. There's no need then for sacrifices anymore. There's no need for circumcision anymore. No need for the priesthood of the Old Testament. No more temple. No need, Jesus says, to insist on fasting. No need for yearly days of atonement. Because the old is gone, the new has come. This is a new era, he's saying. We probably don't understand how scandalous this was to the people listening to Jesus. And it did take a while for the church to really understand it. One of the great problems for the church in the New Testament era was false teachers called Judaizers. These men were Jews. They went around the new church, the new converts, saying, it wasn't enough to trust in Jesus as Savior. You need to be circumcised as well. That's what the whole letter of Galatians addresses. But Jesus says, that's not it. You can't attach me to the way things were. You can't attach Jesus to pre-existing ideas. And friends, how many people today are still making that mistake? How many people in our province have the idea that if you go to church every so often, if you're a member of a church, if you pay in, if you live a reasonably good life, then God will be pleased with you? How many people have the idea that if you dress nice for church, if you don't smoke, drink, or swear, if you give to charity, then on the day of judgment, everything will be grand, and God will usher you very happily into heaven? But friends, that's exactly the same mistake the Pharisees made here. That's trying to patch Jesus on to our own little ideas and systems. People who give the Son of God only a couple of hours on a Sabbath morning, or the odd prayer here or there, or they slip him a few pounds every week, they're trying to pour new wine into old wineskins. They're trying to attach Jesus on to their lives like an accessory. And by and large, their lives are quite undisturbed by Jesus. He makes no real difference, no real impact. He's got no real relevance to them. He's on the sidelines. He's a bit of a hobby, but nothing more. So many people try to reduce Jesus to a mere optional added extra. And I wonder if some of us are doing just that. Friends, are we trying to hold on to Christ and the world at the same time? Are we trying to serve two masters? Are we trying to keep a foot in both camps? Maybe some of us are living for money rather than the kingdom of God. Maybe some of us were professing the name of a Christian, but we're trying to have the lifestyle of the ungodly at the same time. Jesus says you can't do that. You can't serve two masters. You can't add Jesus on to something else. He demands total, exclusive love and obedience. I wonder if some of us today are falling into the trap of trying to attach Jesus onto our lives without really wanting him to disturb things too much. Jesus says that's impossible. That can't happen. Because I demand everything from you. He doesn't come into our lives merely to redecorate or even to renovate. He comes to demolish the whole building and start again. So we can't just expect to add him onto our lives. Perhaps that seems scandalous to you this morning. But friend, it's our place to submit humbly to his rule, to bow our knee and make him Lord of all. His scandalous call of Levi, he comes into the world to call sinners like you and me to follow him. His scandalous eating with sinners, he comes only to those who see their sin and realize their state before him. And his scandalous attitude to two traditions, he demands our total 100% love and commitment. You can't have two masters, Jesus says. It's the world or it's Jesus. You can't have both. In the words of Joshua 24:15, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. And may all of us be able to say, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord.